Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We'll discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we will have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send us an email or a favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. Or visit our website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, if you would like to hear prior shows, they're archived on that website, recipeforpeacenow.com. Thanks. Now let's get started. This time we're going to be talking about foundational beliefs. And we deal with those quite a bit. So as we often do on this show, let's define what we're talking about first. What is a foundational belief that we've seen, that we know about, within our context? Within the context of an alternative dispute resolution, a mediation, a workshop, a seminar even, when we deal with participants who need to have a group dynamic and reach a successful outcome. So what is foundational belief within our context? We have lots of people. Thank you all for being here. Thank you for your participation. Let's see. Petra and others. This is a real foundational definition, eh? Petra says that our foundational belief within our context is an idea presented and accepted as fact, even if someone else's opinion and not a factual basis. It's an idea presented and accepted as fact, because it's fact in the person's mind, even if it's someone else's opinion and there's no factual basis. So that's a foundational belief. And really, that's a belief is, well, not necessarily so factually based, right? Yes, but we take it as a real-life idea, a core idea, don't we? Alex and others are talking about childhood, that it's belief instilled in childhood by a respected family member. Belief instilled in childhood by a respected family member. We think that it's fact and we believe it with all our heart because we've believed it our whole lives. Someone taught it to us at a young age. And oftentimes, foundational beliefs really have to do with our idea of the world, right? Yeah. Our idea of what's right and what's wrong and how things should be, right? And so we work to that should be because it's really, we don't even think about it. We know that that's what's right. Yeah, because it's been instilled in us. Nadia and others are talking about cultural tradition. That it is a foundational belief is really has to do with your cultural traditions. That's taught in childhood, right? Yeah. It might even be a culture, and people are talking about cultures that you not only get born into, but that you choose to belong to. A lot of people join kind of a group, even if it's not real formal. It might be an organization. It might be very formal. And that group has traditions that appeal to us, that speak to, well, what we think is true and right and what should be done, right? Yeah, a lot of times we choose our cultural tradition, although we think of it as something that we're born into. Same thing for religious. A lot of people are talking about religious, right? Yeah. An interesting way of putting it, Cheryl is saying that that it's a group agreement, your foundational beliefs are a group agreement that you've, well, kind of proselytized, right? And a lot of times if we choose a different maybe than our childhood cultural group, to join for a variety of reasons, but it's a choice. People are even more strict about the traditional belief, right? Because they've really bought in. A lot of times people who are born into something, they go, oh, that's nice, and my family thinks it, but they kind of get a little bit away from it. But people who have chosen are really serious. They've really bought in. They've really accepted and acknowledged and want to kind of, as Cheryl says, proselytize. They want to tell it to everyone. Yeah. A lot of people are saying that that's a way for people who are joining a different kind of a cultural group or maybe a religious group to kind of prove that they are serious, right? Yeah, because a lot of times, let's think about this, if this is a true statement. I think, and people are saying this too, a lot of times, and thank you for all of your participation, a lot of times people change into a cultural religious group because they are involved with somebody in that group, right? Yeah, like they marry somebody who's in that group, and so they accept in. They go, yes, I want to be I'm taking the whole thing. You know, they reform. They change and become that tradition, that religion, right? Yeah. Yeah. And so then they kind of proselytize. They get excited. Well, because it's new and it's exciting. Hussein says that a foundational belief within our context is a strongly and righteously held idea of the world and people in it. A strongly and righteously held idea of the world and the people in it. Righteously, yes. Very, very fundamental belief, right? Strongly and righteously held idea of the world and the people in it. Yeah. You know, and Felicia and others are saying that a foundational belief within our context is a core belief that impacts responses. Yes. It impacts how you deal with our group dynamic. It impacts how you're going to be able to compromise and reach consensus. It impacts how we deal with each other, which is the reason that we care. Because it's ordinarily, do we care about other people's foundational beliefs if it doesn't impact us? No. It's personal. They're entitled to it, right? Yeah. But this is a belief that really impacts us, that really causes us to think, to have a reaction, to really impact the way the person deals in the group, which is the key to it, right? How it is that we actually get along, how we are able to negotiate with each other. How are we able to reach consensus? Very important. Yeah. So it's a core belief that impacts. So what specifically types of foundational beliefs do we see within our context? And then we're going to talk about what we should do with it. Because we are a practical show, and I like theory as well as anybody else, but quite frankly, we like to know what to do about stuff, don't we? We like to be practical and to think about what it is that we need to do, what it is that we need to accommodate. Yeah, what it is we're dealing with, really, and how it's going to impact our group dynamic, right? Right. So what types of foundational beliefs do we What do we really see within our context? Quite a few people are talking about a foundational belief that is personal. See, we've been talking about beliefs that are either instilled, Well, I guess it's an instilled belief, but or outside, because they're cultural and religious and group agreement and like that. But Thomas and others are talking about diminished self-worth because someone said so. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you see that. Sometimes people think they can't or think they're too dumb, right? Or think that they're not the right person. Well, you can clearly see that they can and they are the right person, but they've really gotten in their head that they have diminished self-worth. People are seeing women have that. Maybe. I think I see it with all kinds of people, though. And sometimes it is a, I don't know how to say this, but a kind of a class thing. Does that make sense? Yeah. And it is kind of evident in the way that people react, in the way that people speak, and in their responses to, can you do this, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and I always point, well, you know, you have to be careful because, of course, you want to not insult anybody. So you can't just point out that someone has diminished self-worth and they think that they are less than you think they are. I mean, you have to be tactful, right? Because that's insulting and it's personal. Yeah. But you know who Albert Einstein is, right? The great mathematician and scientist and all kinds of good things. Well, when he was in school, because he was different, his teacher, who is, of course, a very influential person, right, in your schooling, in your life when you were young, his teacher actually said that he was mentally slow and unsociable and couldn't learn because he was different, mentally slow, unsociable, and couldn't learn. Albert Einstein, right? And see, you say this to the whole group about we're going to learn how to do something and we're all smart, right? Right. And his mother actually, well, probably said something rude, which is not on the record. And she actually took him out of school and what would be called homeschooled him, actually taught him at home. Because she understood that he was not mentally slow, he was mentally brilliant. But if he had stayed in school, or if his mother had not had confidence in him and hadn't done that, and had just sent him to a school for the developmentally disabled, which existed even in those days, kind of just institutionalized him because he was dumb and unsociable, right? And unteachable. He would have not risen. He would have had a self-fulfilling prophecy and been developmentally disabled. Yeah. And never have been anything, never have invented anything, never have done anything, right? Yeah. Thomas Edison had the same thing. He was called addled, and that it would be useless for him to continue in school. They said he was a hopeless case. Thomas Edison, hopeless, right? When you're a little kid and somebody tells you that, you believe it. And it impacts you. It impacts you for the rest of your life. Now, both of those men had very strong mothers who said, no, you are not. The teacher is wrong. You are just smarter and more brilliant. You see? And that impacted them too, because they were able to rise, right? Because somebody more important than teacher, who threw both of them out of school, not the same teacher, of course, but they both, basically speaking, got thrown out of school for being mentally disabled. Mm-hmm. Developmentally disabled. And socially inept. And there's something wrong with him, and he's weird, and I can't teach that because it's too dumb. Wow. Isn't that something? Yeah. That means yes. Yes. And sometimes people are kind of thrown in the less than good pile because of hereditary bias and stuff like that. And there's really nothing wrong with them. But they have a worldview, a foundational belief that they're not up to snuff, that they're not capable, right? Yeah. So that's a real foundational belief that we have to think on, yeah? Diminished self-worth. A lot of women especially are talking about gender inequality. The idea that women are lesser than men and less capable, that is somewhat cultural too. But you'd be surprised. There's kind of an underlay. And you think that men are enforcing that because they're being condescending, which is true too, but a lot of times women have accepted that inequality. And therefore, they feel that they're unequal, that they're not as capable, right? Yeah. And therefore, they are less of a team member. Yeah. Or, yeah, people are talking, thank you for all of your participation. Anne and others are talking about women overcompensating and thinking that they need, I don't know how to put this more delicately, extracurricular activities in order to get ahead. Yeah. And that'll impact the group dynamic something fierce, especially if the person accepting the extracurricular activity is either in the group or above the group, as in the boss who is the final say on the group. That happens sometimes if you are the third party impartial who is an actual paid person, right? Yeah. That's something to take into account, boy. That is, yeah, it's a concept. And it is very much an interesting point that you need to understand so that it underlies what's happening and the group dynamic. And it also underlies the group dynamic as to whether or not the other people understand and have an opinion about it. We're going to talk about that in a second. But gender inequality. Race inequality, Marcel and others are talking about racial inequality, that people view different ethnicities differently and respond to them differently. I hope not so much anymore, but it is a truth. It's a bigger truth in some of the non-U.S. countries that I deal with, because I do international business. Gender equality also. There are certain pockets still where it is very, even in the United States, where these types of things are fairly overt. Goes to the civility rules, right? And it's something to think about. I don't see it so much in business, because I usually deal with the management type people, and everybody's already kind of proven themselves on the gender and the racial and the ethnic and the whole bit, right? But the more levels you go down, kind of, the more you see that. The more you see there's an underlying bias. Yeah. Yeah, people call them bigots. Probably true. Yes, Eleanor's talking about religious faith of a chosen path. More likely to proselytize. I know that. Yeah. If you will give me 1 second, I have an important phone call. My mother's calling. Hang on a second. Yeah? Are you in trouble? Oh, because I'm on the air. Goodbye. I'm sorry about that. Proves it's a live show, doesn't it? Yes. Thank you. Yes. No, she's just fine. She accidentally hit phone instead of text. Yeah, but you know, when your elderly mother calls, you have to actually answer these things. At least I have to actually answer these things, which does indeed impact my group dynamic because I have a foundational belief in family values. Yeah, that's a foundational belief too, because it makes a difference. And I understand that I have that foundational belief. I have thought about it in relationship to others, right? Because I truly think deep down, and we all have these foundational beliefs, that if you're not nice to your family, and that if you are not on speaking terms with your mother, for example, or you don't treat them nice, and you don't really, you know, go and help them and like that. I mean, I would have actually said, thank you all for being here, and left if she was in trouble in some way, right? Yeah, I would have. And I think that people who won't and say rude things about their parents and hope that they die, I don't think so well of them. And I know that. That's my foundational belief, and it colors what I think of people. And I think very hard about it and try to be neutral because I know that not everybody has my same foundational values, right? Yeah. Yes. Yes, it does. A lot of you are telling me all kinds of things. Yeah, I do. When she got old, she moved in with me. You know what I mean? It's a foundational value that I secretly think others should have, right? A foundational belief. And I am aware of that. That is my bias. That is my thought about it. That is what I really, 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 really feel deep down, right? Yeah. And it's funny because I am a Christian, but I don't proselytize. If you ask me, we'll talk about it. But that's not my real foundational belief. It is. But I accept other people's religions and that they have a right to them. And I've dealt with people who are atheists, right? Don't believe in God. I've dealt with people who are less mainstream religious, right? And we understood that we differed, right? Yeah. Yeah, people are calling them pagan religions. No, I would consider anything that lots of people practice, a mainstream religion, like being a Muslim or a Hindu or something. But even a more unusual earth-type religions and things. Hey, I won't try to convert you. Try not to convert me. And we all understand that that is faith. And it influences how we deal with others. Because it influences our idea of right and wrong. But family, that's a real core fundamental of that belief, a value that is important. Yeah, and it's important to people. And it's important if it impacts the group, it impacts your opinion of the other people in the group. As to whether or not you think they're good people, really. Yeah, it's really that's what it comes down to. Whether or not I think that you're a good person or not, should that impact the business of the group? No, it really shouldn't. Because we're in business, it's consensus, and like that. Does it impact how I trust you? Yeah. People are going, yeah, that's the ticket. Will I think that your word is as good? Will I take you at your word so much if I don't think that you have my values or that you're a moral person? Wow, let's think about that. Yeah, it will impact that, won't it? It will. Because I will not really think that you're as good a person as that you could be, right? Secretly. Uh-huh. And you have to think about that as a leader and think about the fact that you need to act in a business-like manner and that the other participants do too. This is not a personality context. This is not a personality contest. It is not a personality. You don't have to like each other. You know, at the beginning of the show, I say not exactly friends, but at least willing participants. That's it. You don't have to be friends. You don't have to like each other. You don't have to have a lot in common. The thing you need to do is get to the successful outcome. Okay, so now we've talked about all kinds of underlying fundamental beliefs, religious, which might be impacting this, especially a chosen religion. That kind of makes a difference, right? Yeah. This is an interesting point, too, that quite a few people are making. Jorge and others are saying that a foundational belief that you see a lot, and this is absolutely true, is kind of a belief of self-importance, right? Self-importance. I am more important than you are. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you should listen to me and come around to my view. I'm more important than you are. I am more intelligent. I am higher up. Yeah. I am higher. I'm an administrator. I'm a boss, and you are not, right? I'm more important than you are. That's something you see a lot, huh? An idea of self-importance. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the answer is, I don't think so. But people do think it. And they think that they're more important, and that's a fundamental belief. Peter and others are saying that all of this could be a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Especially the negative ones, but possibly the other ones too, possibly the more important one. If I think that I'm important, I will act accordingly, and I will try to influence others, right? Because I'm kind of the boss. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting point. Jorge and others are saying that if you're the leader, which we really usually are, that kind of means that you have a good sense of your own self-worth, of your own kind of importance in a way, right? Yeah. And that it makes a difference in how you deal with people. Mm-hmm. I don't care for the arrogant act. We all know this. I'm not real fond of it. I go more for the we're all in this together. I think that it reaches consensus better, that it is a better way of getting people to respond. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's my way of negotiating, really. Mm-hmm. I like to be, even though I'm the leader, I also consider myself a team member, a group member. I'm just the group member that's in charge, right? Right. And that's one of the main things. That's one of the keys to it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm the group member that's in charge. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Self-fulfilling prophecy. Well, that's really just the examples, isn't it? With Albert Einstein and Thomas Edison. Because they're so famous, and they were so brilliant, and it could have gone so wrong, right? Self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what kind of fundamental beliefs do we see, and what should we do about them? How about the positive ones and the negative ones? We'll talk about them all at the same time, or else we're going to run out of time. Yeah, I am going to try to leave a little bit for the recipes. People like them. Sometimes we talk and we get so excited and we're so interested that we don't quite get to the recipe part. Mm-hmm. Yeah. These are going to call them the learn from childhood ones. Mm-hmm. Grace and others are saying that you've got both positive and negative, that you learn that you're either smart or stupid, right? That you're either smart or stupid. And there is a kind of a movement in the United States about science and math and stuff like that, that it should be, that all students should be capable of doing it and understand that they can. Because I must confess that when I was in school, those things were taught kind of difficult in a way. You know, they were made obtuse. And now there's a really wonderful movement to show people the practicality, right? Yeah. You know, when I did algebra and trigonometry and like that, I couldn't see it. I didn't understand how I would possibly use such a thing in the real world and why I was doing it. Yeah? And because of that, it was hard to get enthusiastic, right? But now they've got wonderful programs, and that's because people think they're stupid and can't if it's presented to them in a hard way when they're kids and they didn't embrace it, right? Yeah. So learn from childhood that you're either smart or stupid. Mm-hmm. Yeah, athletic or non-athletic too, but that doesn't, I don't think, impact us as within our context. Yeah, but that's another thing that people learn. Mm-hmm. Also appearances too, good looking and ugly. That people are insisting that does impact, Shelley and others are saying that does impact the group dynamic because it impacts how people think about themselves, and that's either diminished self-worth or kind of puffed up self-worth. And I suppose that's true as a personality trait. And your appearance does make a difference, I think even more when you are young, because when you get older and you are high enough up to be in one of our groups because you're a business person, right, you can pretty much do something about it. You either embrace what you look like, or you get it kind of modified, right? Yeah. But that is a self-worth issue that follows you. Yes, thank you. People are saying, especially if you have someone in the group who's engaging in extracurricular activities, right? Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Does make a difference. Mm-hmm. Edward and others, I'm going to call this being able to accommodate anything is a really positive foundational belief, right? Yeah, I can handle this. Whatever you throw at me, I can handle it. If I don't know it, we'll look it up. It's not a problem, right? Yeah, I can handle it. I can accommodate it. I am able to do whatever it is that's asked of me, right? Yeah. And that's a positive foundational belief, as opposed to there's only one way. Mm-hmm. And I know it. It's been done this way for a really long time. And that's the way it should be done. One way, my way, the way it's always been done, the traditional way. And that's a real negative foundational belief, because they'll have trouble thinking outside the box, right? Yeah. There's only one way of doing it, and this is the way it should be done. What's the problem? The problem is that it's not working, and we have to think now. Think now is complicated, right? Right. One way is not. Think now. Always a challenge. The next thing, we kind of touched on this already. Suki and others are talking about what I'm going to call people opinions as a foundational belief. Kind of the concept of other versus us. Yeah, Suki's got that in quotation marks. Other, in quotation marks, versus us, in quotation marks. That we are not similar. That we are, I can't understand you because you're so different than me. That needs to be overcome. And of course, people have a positive attitude that says, I don't care what you look like. I don't care where you come from. Let's get this done. Because this is outside of all that. It's business. It's not personal. Right? And that's what it truly is, what it comes down to usually within our context. It's business. It shouldn't be real personal. Now, if it can get personal if it's positive, so that we work together better, right? But really, we're here for our successful outcome. We're here to reach consensus. We're here to be successful, right? And what I think of you on a personal basis is a fundamental belief, and you probably have an opinion about me that's a fundamental belief too, and we're going to set those aside because we need to reach consensus. We don't have to be friends. We don't have to like each other. But we have a common interest in getting this done, whatever this is. And we're going to do it. We're going to get it done. People are calling it how it's always been and should be versus empathy and listening with an open mind. Right. Yes. So that's what we should do to encourage positive and discourage negative fundamental beliefs. Yeah. How it's always been and should be versus empathy and listening with an open mind. We're going to have to. We're going to have to go on the empathy path. And remember, of course, that empathy is not agreement. It is understanding. Right? Empathy is not agreement. I don't have to agree with you. I just need to understand the basis for what you're saying. Right? I need to understand what it is that you are telling me. That's what the empathy part is. So what should we do to encourage that? We're practical people. What should we do to encourage positive and discourage negative fundamental beliefs? Because they're impacting us. Because we don't care about the ones that aren't impacting the group. But deep down, all of them impact us, don't they? Right. Yeah. So they impact us. Fundamentally, a lot of you, thank you all for being here. This is so wonderful because I know that you've been here before, because a lot of people are saying, George and others, that you need to explain and be a good example of the civility rules. Yes, you need to enforce them, and you need to be a good example yourself. The civility rules, for those of us who are new, and welcome also, yes, and please come again. The civility rules are very basic, and they kind of change with the situation, right? because we need to know what our dynamic is and how many, if we need to write them down practically. Basically speaking, they say, I will not be rude to anyone else, and we will in good faith work together to a successful outcome. I will not be rude to anyone else, and we will in good faith work together towards a successful outcome. That's the civility rules at their very, very core. And you need to be a good example of it yourself. You can't enforce something that you are not following. How can you? Right? You need to be a good example of the civility rules, and you need to enforce them from the beginning, not after things have gotten out of hand, right? Depending on the group, I mean, sometimes you don't have to, but I announce the civility rules almost always. Just plain out and out say them. And say that we're going to take turns. When I tell people how it's going to work for this group, for this mediation, for this alternative dispute resolution, right? For this workshop, for this seminar, or for this training, I tell people right up front the process, explain the civility rules. And hopefully they all nod and understand it, but it's nothing hurts to say it. And I like to say it right up front because I think it's important that people understand that that's the way it's going to be, and I enforce them always. Not I let it slide until it gets really bad. No, because if you let it slide until it gets really bad, you have no place to go, right? Yeah. The civility rules will never be enforced because you've already ruined it. You've already let it slide. You must be a good example. Never lose your temper. Never get rude. Yeah. And a good example of understanding your own fundamental beliefs, you know, your own foundational ones, yeah, and understand how that impacts how you see others because it does, right? Yeah. Yes, how are we going to encourage positive and discourage negative foundational beliefs? At least they're popping up during our group, our dynamic. We're going to ask the 5W questions. Lots of people, Catherine and others, are saying to ask the 5Ws. Very, very important. We do it all the time. I like to do it up front. I like to do it while we are in negotiation. And there's nothing wrong with doing it in private if it's not something you think that the whole group needs to particularly be privy to. Right? Right. So, what does that mean? It means that we are going to ask the 5W questions. Who, what, where, when, why? Because it gets down to the answer of what kind of foundational belief is this? What's causing this kind of unusual reaction? What's the point of this? What is it that we are, what's the basis? What's the foundation for that belief, right? Because we need to know, because we're going to have empathy. Okay. We're going to listen with an open mind. And we'll understand a foundational basis for an opinion, right? Yeah. I love the 5W questions. Who, what, where, when, why? It is up to discretion and the civility rules as to how you ask them, right? Always polite, always with interest, and always listened, the answer listened to with an open mind, right? If you ask the 5W questions, it's not an argument. It is an informational gathering, right? It's not the beginning of an argument. It's the beginning of understanding. Yeah, that's the ticket, which is how sometimes we even ask them in private. Yeah, because you have to listen with empathy and with patience. Yes, because sometimes the answer to the who, what, where, when, and why questions is not so easily defined by the person answering the question. Because if it's really a foundational belief, they haven't really thought about the foundation usually. Does that make sense? It's kind of something they know. We have those kind of beliefs. Some you just know. And kind of a thing where you have to find out if that's true, if that's valid, right? Yeah. And it's an important thought. It's important to know what it is that we're really thinking. And sometimes people aren't sure. They got to have a little bit of patience to get the answer to that. It's not a pat answer. If you think about your foundational beliefs, they were created over time too. And the question is kind of if they're personal or if they're learned. Because personal is experience-based, right? Long time in coming. Learned is something that you were taught, that someone else told you, that comes from your culture, from your tradition, right? Yeah. And sometimes it is best to ask the 5W questions, not in front of the whole group, or one of the 5W questions, but not in front of the whole group, but in just to the person that you are dealing with, right? Yeah, just to them. Just to ask, what's the basis? Why? Right? Yeah. And that is very, and sometimes you need to do it privately. And that's where the idea of having food in the room came from, right? The food with Recipe for Peace now. We're not going to get to the recipes today. I know people do like it. We may only get to one, but I'm going to try to do better about actually having recipes. I promise them, and then sometimes we don't make it. The food is a tool. It may indeed be that we're hungry. I mean, that could be possible. But mainly it is a tool so that we have the ability to have a convivial atmosphere and to really get to talk to someone as leader and find out the who, what, where, when, and why, especially the why, if their behavior or their insistence on something is unusual. Right? Yeah. And that's very important. Very much we have to think about it. Very much this is thing that is ingrained in us. Why? And you don't want to do it in front of the whole group, right? The foundational beliefs. It makes for a convivial atmosphere to have some food. And it allows us to have a very pleasant time out if we think we need it because we're about to go uncivil. And you can feel that. I know that some of you don't have so much experience, but you have experience with people. And you can feel when things are about to get less than civil. Right? Right. So, what we're going to do is we're going to have some food in the room, some potluck. And I'm going to say exactly what I always say because it's so important. If you're going to have food, you have to take a survey. You have to see if anybody has a food allergy, a food prohibition, a religious prohibition to some sort of food. Very, very important, because you don't want anybody to have a bad experience. It's a party, right? Also, you ask people when they bring food to come with a list, not just what it is called, meatloaf, but what is in it, so that we can decide if we can eat it or not, right? Right, yeah. And I think we should have one safe recipe and one adventure recipe. And I know I seem to usually get to the safe recipes, and then I don't manage to get to the adventure recipe. So let's do the adventure one. Let's do the adventure one first. Yeah. We've got a vote going. You guys would rather have, you'd rather have the safe recipe. Okay. See, this is a live show, and I take your word for it. Thank you all for being here. Okay, the safe recipe is one, and we'll get to the, we may not get to both of them. We'll get to the adventure one next time for sure, because we've been carrying it for a couple of weeks. The safe recipe is one that does not have too many ingredients. This one is a little more than some because it's beef stew. But it is ingredients that everyone can eat because we've taken the survey. And that my people would have eaten before and know they can eat. Now, this is a global show, so my safe recipe might not be yours. Because where I am, a curry, for example, would be highly unusual. And it would be my adventure recipe. Mm-hmm. So you have to decide, but this would be my safe recipe because my people would have seen all this food and be familiar with it, know if they can eat it. So it's beef stew. It's kind of a very basic one. Yes, if you want to make it more adventurous, you could add some wine and make it a little bit richer, maybe some sherry. But this is the safe recipe, and we're not going to do that. Yes. And don't sneak unusual things into recipes. People, honest to God, I've seen people put fish sauce into a beef thing, and it's like, no, don't bring that because people could be allergic to fish and they wouldn't expect it. Yeah. So don't do surprise stuff. Let's have 2 pounds of boneless kind of firm meat. I like chuck. It's cheap. I can get it. Or something called stew meat, which is usually kind of chuck, that comes here. You just buy it actually already cut into chunks. It's called stew meat, which might be a frightening thought, but it's kind of like ends and stuff. And it's really quite inexpensive, and if you cook it long enough, it's all delicious. Okay, 2 pounds of boneless beef chuck, we're going to call it chuck, that we're going to make into squares, we're going to cube, because it's stew, yeah. Let's have a couple tablespoons of flour, because we're going to need it for a little thickening. A couple tablespoons of oil. Nice big onion, I like a sweet onion, that we're going to chop up. 4 garlic cloves, I'm going to chop those too. You think I use too much garlic, use less. A lot of people think I use a lot of garlic. Let's have 4 celery stalks, we're going to slice it. Yeah, cause it looks nice. A nice red pepper, core, vein, seed, slice up. Well, let's make it in cubes because it'll go with the meat better. Yeah, not just long slices. Let's cube that. Let's do the same thing to a green one, core, seed, cube. Uh-huh. I like a teaspoon of allspice, ground allspice in this. I think it gives it a lovely flavor. You just buy it in the spice department, not the little balls, because you have to fish for the things, and they're hard to find. So if you just use ground allspice, you don't have to fish for anything. I don't know why they make those balls. I guess they're delightful, but geez, it's kind of like cloves or something. You got to fish for them. Let's have 3 cups of beef stock. You can kind of put in about 2.5 and then see how it goes, because you don't want this too looky. It is stew, not soup. And let's have about 1 pound of squash, because it's delightful. It's, if you're going to use a real one and you're going to cut it, you have to core it and like that. I find them very hard to cut, and they're kind of hard for me to come by. But around here you can get prepped pieces of squash frozen. And so I'm going to do that. Let's use a pound, one of those 16-ounce, one of those pound bags of frozen squash. It is pretty firm, so you know, so you can put it in just like regular squash, basically, maybe a little bit later. If you're going to use the regular squash, you have to cook it more than the frozen one, because the frozen, it's fresh squash, but it's kind of been processed. But still, it's pretty darn hard. Thoughts, patted dry, right? And let's have four nice tomatoes that we're going to coarsely chop. If you want, you can use whole canned tomatoes. It won't look as nice in the stew, though. And, of course, we're going to make a big pot of rice to serve with this, right? Right. We've got our beets cubed. We're going to take our oil. We're going to put it in the saucepan, the big one. We're going to cook the onion and the garlic and the celery. Let's throw in the allspice, too, because it's lovely and it gets all fragrant. 3 minutes, softened, right? We're going to kind of shove it to the side and add the beef. Or you could take it out, but it's easier to just shove it to the side of the pot. Brown it on all sides, right? Because we're not really cooking it through, but we need to seal it. Otherwise, it's going to be not as good. Mm-hmm. You'd be surprised. I have in my day gotten lazy and skipped that step. It's not a good idea. You should brown the meat on all sides. It just doesn't come out as well. You know that flour? We're going to sprinkle it in and keep stirring. And like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we coated the beef in the flour. Did I say that? Plastic bag, flour, coat, toss. Throw the rest of the flour in now, stir it around, right? Mm-hmm. Couple minutes. Take the whole thing, and you might as well take it off the heat or push it to the side, because we're going to stir in the stock, and you don't want it to splash on you, right? That's why I used a really big pot. Stir, kind of put it in gradually so it doesn't splash. Bring it to a boil, put back on the heat, bring it to a boil. Give it a nice stir again occasionally, right? Cover, reduce the heat, simmer, hour and a half, so that the meat and everything's all incorporated and stuff, yeah? Now we're going to add the vegetables, because they didn't need to be cooking that long. They're going to turn into squish and be ugly. We're going to add the peppers and the squash. 15 minutes. It cooks them through. They're nice and firm still and hot, and they look nice. Otherwise, you're going to make everything look all stringy because the meat takes a while to cook through, but the vegetables don't. Okay, we've got our peppers. I've got our squash. 10 minutes, 15 tops. Throw in the tomatoes at the last minute. Another 5 minutes, just because tomatoes are soft, but you want them to all be incorporated. Ha! Huh. The beef is now cooked through and tender, because we've tested one piece, right? Yeah, it's always good to taste. And we're ready. It's all done. Yummy. Serve it with some rice. Yeah, I like to put the rice, something on the side, even a condiment on the side, because it's not very spicy. People are asking about all kinds of added spices. The answer is no. Put them on the side. I like to make things sweet rather than spicy, because if you've got the Tabasco sauce eaters, that's why there's Tabasco sauce, right? Right. It's delicious, fabulous, yes, and everybody likes it, and we are out of time, my friends. We are not going to make it to the adventure recipe. I will really try to do it next time. Mm-hmm. Thank you all for being here. Thank you for all of your participation. Thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. Thank you for actually adding your valued opinions. If you'd like to find us, we are at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. The website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows are archived on that website. All the prior shows are archived on recipeforpeacenow.com. Thank you for coming. Thank you for being here, and please do come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.